Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. It's Friday, which means the news roundup, where we talk about some of the regional stories making news this week. And up first, a great white shark visits Woods Hole. While the Cape's become a white shark hotspot, it's mainly on the outer Cape, not Buzzards Bay. This rare occurrence happened on July 4th holiday, and CAI's Gildas Geis joins us with the details on that. I think that was a surprise to a lot of people.
Yeah, it's very rare. That's what the shark experts are saying. But first, we'll go back to talking about what Margaret Bowles and Maddie Cronin experienced that day. These two young ladies were out paddleboarding, taking photos off of Stony Beach. It was 4th of July. I talked to Margaret for this story, and she told me she's been coming to Woods Hole in the summers since she was a little kid. And, you know, when she would have friends come, they'd ask, you know, oh, there are sharks? She'd be like, no, there's no sharks. Of course, there's not no sharks. There's just not that many. So, yeah, they were out there. They're paddling. Maddie was actually taking a video the moment that Margaret saw this 8 inches of dorsal fin sticking it out of the water. There's a video on our social media the moment she realizes. And so, yeah, they just hightailed it back to shore. And when they got to shore, they realized they had the fin on video in their pictures. And so they sent it off to some experts. And they were like, yeah, that's a great white shark.
And when she first looked at it, she thought, no, it's got to be a baby or something, right?
Yeah.
We thought, you know, there's no way this is a great white shark. And if it is, it's like a juvenile or something. Gave it a whole nother dimension when they told us over the phone that it was a fully grown great white whose face would have been, you know, within 2 feet of my friend's paddleboard.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, so one of the experts that they sent their photo off to was Greg Scomel. He works for the State Division of Marine Fisheries. He's a shark biologist. I talked to him as well. I asked him, I was like, how did you identify this from the picture? He explained it has to do with the color, has to do with the shape, but also the scale. With Margaret in the picture, he's, you know, able to tell, no, that's a fully grown great white shark. He did say that it was very unlikely that the shark would have bitten them. I think that's important to note that sharks don't want to eat people.
Right.
If they do, you know, bite a person, it's an accident. It's not a very enjoyable accident, but just keeping, I guess, relative risk in mind here.
Right. And they were really good natured about it. They would say, go back in the water. Of course we're going to go back in the water. So it's all good. And I was just really surprised that it was Stony Beach because it's so shallow. It just seems, you know, such an odd place. But the sharks are arriving, right? So this one could have just been on its way and took a little detour.
Yeah, that's what Greg Scomel said. He said it's very rare for sharks to be in Buzzards Bay, but when they are, they're on their way to the Outer Cape where all the delicious seals live.
All right. Also, this week, State Senator Julian Sear made a pitch to repeal the state's happy hour ban, and he made that from the Provincetown Brewery.
Yeah, so Senator Sear says special deals on alcohol would help businesses that have struggled since the pandemic. He noted that the Provincetown Brewing Company, where he made this testimony from, is one of the businesses in his district that's looking to get more people in the door. He noted that Massachusetts is only one of 8 states that continue to prohibit happy hour drink specials, and he says a lot has changed since 1984 to curb drunk driving.
We have since implemented strict penalties, enforced the national drinking age, mandated seatbelt laws, and witnessed the rise of ride-sharing services that have really helped Massachusetts have one of the lowest rates of drunk driving in the country.
And cities and towns would have the option to offer happy hour during specific time windows.
So what's been the reaction to this idea of lifting the ban?
So the Massachusetts Restaurant Association already has made it clear they're against the proposal. They say it would create unfair competition. And the organization representing state liquor stores says it's also against any legislation allowing discounts on alcoholic drinks at restaurants and bars.
All right, well, we'll see where this goes. The Massachusetts Alternative Septic System Test Center has been awarded more than $400,000 from the state for a project studying urine diversion in Falmouth. This is a hot topic. We've done a couple of point programs on this, and it's always people are really interested. So tell us what this is all about.
Yeah, so I think the most significant thing here is that the grant that MassTC got for the state, that's pretty much probably all the money they need. So this project is going forward, and the way that it's going to work, roughly, there's a lot of parts, is that 25 households in impaired watersheds in Falmouth, watersheds that have issues with nutrient pollution, are going to install, basically have urine-diverting toilets installed, and that is basically exactly what it sounds like. It diverts urine from where it would normally go, you know, down the pipes, out the septic system, whatever it may be. And the idea, you know, in the long run is to use that urine for fertilizer in a way that's safe, but that's getting a little ahead of things. For now, they're just looking for enough people to set up these toilets in their house, and a lot of that money from the state is going to be basically subsidies for paying for people to, you know, have these rigged up in their house.
And so hopefully, I guess what the idea is, they get these houses, they collect this data, which helps more people maybe become interested in installing these, right?
Well, and there's a regulatory piece where, like, right now, you know, the state is telling a lot of towns on Cape Cod, I think all the towns on Cape Cod, you got to figure out the nutrient pollution issue. And basically they're like, we need all the solutions we can possibly get. Here's one we think might work, urine diversion. Technically, that's not, like, legally accepted right now as a way of reducing nutrient pollution in watersheds. So this will basically be MassTC's chance to prove to the state and other regulatory bodies that this is, like, a safe and legitimate and environmentally conscious way to deal with the nutrient pollution issue.
All right, we'll stay on that story.
Yeah, we'll see.
CAI's Gilda Geis, thanks.
Thank you.
If you have a dog, you no doubt have noticed it's an active tick season. Dogs are not the only ones being bitten. Martha's Vineyard Hospital reporting an increase in tick-related visits to the ER. Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times has that story. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Minnie.
So what are we seeing as far as numbers? Is it a lot higher?
That's a good question. I think the stats we have, the hospital shared with us what they had last year. And it's about 200 people came in for tick-related things like bites or rashes or the kind of classic bullseye. And the same time this year, we're seeing about 250. So it's not, safe to say it's not a huge explosion, but, you know, I think it's a troubling trend. Yeah. I think it falls in line with what's been reported in the Northeast as well, is that the CDC is reporting a real increase during these peak seasons.
Yeah. And I guess according to the Mass Department of Public Health, you have this in the story that tick-related emergency department visits are higher in 2025 than the past 3 years, not just the last year.
Yeah. CDC was reporting that as well. Kind of this peak, during this peak part of the year. And I think, you know, we tried to pinpoint if there's one particular tick that might be involved in these on the island. And the hospital say, no, we can't really defer that. But I think the reason we're digging into this, and I think a lot of attention around the island is the increase in Lone Star ticks.
Right.
And we have good, you know, I don't think there are hard stats, but the officials that are involved are saying every year it seems like these Lone Star ticks are getting worse and worse, or more and more, I should say. And we also, you know, we keep in touch with the hospital in terms of how many people are testing positive for alpha-gal. And that's that, you know, allergic reaction that you'll get from meat or any kind of animal product. And the increase in that is just really dramatic. In 2020, just two people had tested positive for alpha-gal at the hospital, and that's last year was 400, I believe.
Wow. Yeah,
that's a real dramatic increase there. And, you know, I think it's people are really starting to get annoyed is one word, but you know, I think there's some fear too of just going outside.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, it's not just the vineyard. This is a trend across the Northeast that we're seeing, and it's we've been sort of keeping our eye on the vineyard with the Lone Star ticks because, as you mentioned, there are more and more, and they're very different than the black-legged tick, right? The deer tick, because that tick kind of hangs out waiting for you to walk by, where the Lone Star tick seeks you.
Yeah, right. and kind of the tick expert here is saying that the reason these are a big issue is that they are in backyards and they'll actually kind of scary come after you. But I thought really interesting the Provincetown Independent. I don't know if you talked to them, but they had a story that they're just starting to see Lone Star out there as well on the Outer Cape, which, you know, it's troubling to see kind of this advance.
Yeah, and I guess there's some predictions that the Lone Star tick may sort of overtake the territory of the deer tick. We could see less of those. Yeah, we'll see. So officials are what, promoting prevention as your best defense?
Yeah, obviously, right. Once you get bit, when you have that allergy, it's tough to do. But right, the big thing is kind of gearing up, and you know, permethrin is a big thing to spray that. You know, there's also, you know, daily checks. If you're in an high risk area, make sure you're checking, you know, under your arms and things like that, and making sure you're right. Being preventative.
And the permethrin is something you spray on your clothes and your shoes, not your skin, right? We don't want people to bend. Yeah, and it's supposed to work very well, kills the ticks. So that's always, you know, spray your pants and your socks and your shoes, and it might be your best defense. Yeah. All right, another story. A biplane made an emergency landing on a thin strip of beach on Chappaquiddick on Sunday, and pilot's getting a lot of praise for his actions.
Yeah, it's just like a wild story. I mean, it could have been way worse, but what we are reporting, we haven't been able to talk with the pilot. I think, you know, the FAA is still investigating this, but what we know is Sunday around noon, this guy was reporting some mechanical issues and was forced to do an emergency landing. And I guess Cape Pogue, it's on Chappie, was just the right spot. There was no one on the beach or a few people. And, you know, this is a really kind of thin strip of beach. And there were two people on the plane. And he made the landing there. And then what we heard over the kind of the scanner is that he said, we know what we need. My brother is coming to help us. And, you know, within I don't know the time, but shortly after he took off from the beach.
He fixes the plane and then takes off.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable. And it's, you know, it's an interesting story. I think it highlighted kind of how tight-knit this aerial and first responder community is, because everyone knew who this guy was. And was saying,
you not only know who he is, Sam, but we know the plane. We see it all the time. It's that red plane, right? It's, I mean, you can't miss it.
Yeah, it's they provide kind of aerial tours of the island from above. And actually, really funny, we had a story last year that this woman was bringing her father, her dead father, around as a skeleton. I don't know if anyone remembers that story, but she took the skeleton in a ride in this biplane. Just a remarkable photo we had of that. But anyways, we're kind of a classic Vineyard, you know, group there. And actually, the pilot, his name was Mike Creato, our intern at the Times, that was her uncle that was flying. But it's just, I think it's important to say that, because, you know, when this alarm first run out, people were really scared. Like, we know this guy. I hope, you know, we're really nervous for him. But at the same time, if anyone could do this emergency landing, it was him.
Yeah.
And he did pull it off. We haven't been able to reach him. The FAA is still investigating.
Yeah.
But I'm looking forward to that interview.
Yeah, it'll be a fun interview. All right. Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up, water woes on Nantucket, and black widow spiders do indeed live on Cape Cod. Stay with us. You are listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Harwich names an acting town administrator, and there's been lots of debate about how the town should go about filling that position. Joining us is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So tell us about the new acting town administrator and what the debate is all about.
So the acting town administrator right now is a known quantity. She's assistant town administrator Megan Eldridge. A little bit of background, the previous town administrator, Joe Powers, his contract expired on June 30th. And the select board had 10 days to name some sort of acting or interim town administrator while they look for a new person to fill that position. So they sort of had a special meeting earlier this week on Monday to do that, because they just hadn't met in the last couple of weeks. But the debate centers around, at this point, whether they're going to retain Megan Eldridge as the acting administrator until, or they're going to appoint another interim town administrator. The board can do either. They could make Eldridge the acting or the interim town administrator, or they can hire someone else to sort of fill in for Powers until they find a new permanent town administrator. Now, the board recently, during one of their discussions, they talked about a local resident, Anthony Schiava, who some of your listeners may remember. He was town administrator in Bourne for a number of years, and he was former town manager in Ashland and, you know, retired Air Force Brigadier General. He lives in Harwich, and he said he's available to serve as interim town administrator. He's going to be going to talk to the select board in the next couple of weeks. So right now the select board is, you know, they've got someone at the top of the town right now to take care of the day-to-day administration, but they're debating whether or not they're going to keep Megan Eldridge there or hire an interim. And if they hire an interim, then they have to go through the process to do that.
Right. And of course, the board members have been saying Megan Eldridge is doing a good job. It's not that she's not doing a good job, right?
Exactly. They're just, you know, some of them would like someone a little more experienced or someone who, you know, has engaged in a transition like this before and knows sort of the process for doing that.
All right, and over in Chatham, the Chatham Select Board has decided to put one housing project on the back burner in favor of another. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. The town actually has four housing developments in the process right now, but there are two smaller ones, one on Old Harbor Road and one on Stepping Stones Road, that the town is sort of looking at as maybe attainable housing versus affordable housing. But they had been scheduled to go ahead with some design guidelines for the property at 127 Old Harbor Road. But on a split vote, the board decided that they would put that on the back burner and instead move ahead with the other smaller project, which is on Stepping Stones Road near Monomoy Regional Middle School. Some of the board members feel that that project can be done a lot quicker. It's on land that is currently undeveloped, while the 127 Old Harbor Road property has an old house and a barn on it right now. And there's been some opposition to the 127 Old Harbor Road project. And the board feels that it will be easier and quicker to go ahead with the Stepping Stones project. Now, the board voted 3-2 to do this. So they're not in unanimous lockstep here, but it looks like the 127 Old Harbor Road work is going to be put on the back burner, and the board will continue with the Stepping Stones Road project.
So they're not doing away with that project at 127 Old Harbor. They're just sort of putting it aside for the moment.
Exactly. You know, they've actually done quite a bit of work, had quite a bit of work done by consultants on that project. They did sort of test fits to see how many bedrooms or how many units could go on that property. But they're worried that that those proposals are controversial and it could slow down the process. So they want to go ahead with the what they feel will be a more streamlined and easier to build project on Stepping Stones.
And over in Orleans, a buzz over an error in the town manager's contract regarding vehicle reimbursements. What happens when you add an extra zero? Huh?
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's what happened here. You know, we got a number of emails and calls from people who looked at town manager Kim Newman's contract and said, wait a minute, you know, there's a $4,000 a month automobile allowance in here. And, you know, so we looked at it a little closer, and indeed that was the case. And it turns out that exactly as you said, Mindy, someone added an errant zero onto the $400 a month automobile allowance that had been in her previous contract. Nobody is really sure how this happened, but select board members say that you know, they're aware of it. There was no nefarious motivations here. It was just a mistake, and they'll have to go in and probably amend the contract to correct that error. You know, proofreading.
Yeah.
We know how important
everybody needs an editor, right?
Exactly.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
All right, Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe held their 104th annual powwow over the July 4th holiday. Callie Remillard from the Enterprise Newspapers attended for the first time. Hi, Callie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So tell me a little bit about what you expected and then what you saw. Was it what you expected?
It was everything I expected, but somehow more. So I had seen a lot of photos. You know, we've covered this plenty of times before, sending photographers and stuff, but I didn't know what to expect. You know, a photograph can only show you so much.
And those photos are beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So you can imagine how much more amazing it was in person, having just seen how amazing those photos are to begin with. Being there was, the best way I can describe it is kind of like electric. You know, you have the drummer groups competing in drummer competitions. They're singing and they're chanting. And then you have the dance circle in the middle where all of the competitors come out and there's different types of dances. And it's just beautiful.
Kelsey, you highlighted a few different things I want to ask you about. You wrote about the Eastern women's traditional blanket dance. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that was one of the dances. So they did a lot of traditional dances. They did a Southern traditional one. So the Eastern traditional blanket dance, each of the women comes out and they have these, you know, ornately kind of woven blankets. And everyone's regalia looks different, which I think is one of the most visually striking pieces. You know, you've got all these different colors, different styles. And I think that really kind of adds to how like unique what everyone's doing is. And that dance is, you know, traditionally tells the story of kind of like a woman's, you know, entrance into womanhood. It's supposed to tell the story of a courtship. So it starts with kind of the blanket up over the head. They're kind of covering themselves. And then throughout it, they kind of reveal more of themselves and do some really just beautifully fluid movements with the blanket. And the end is supposed to be kind of like the idea that she and her partner, who just finished courting her, would then be wrapped up together in that blanket. Mm.
And then you also noted another tradition that you enjoyed, which was the men's Eastern war dance.
Yes, that was something unlike anything I've ever seen before. You know, the energy that these men come with, you can tell it's ancestral, what's kind of coming over them in this moment. And it's absolutely beautiful to witness and to hear, you know, the drumming in your chest and see those movements. And they're so fluid, but they're also, like, you know, so powerful. And the regalia, like I said, everyone's so different. You have all these beautiful feathers and these headpieces. And some men have, you know, like clubs and different beadwork on their regalia. I thought that was one of the most really powerful things I've ever seen in my life.
Wow. All right. So the highlight for a lot of people is mm-hmm. the fireball.
Yes.
Tell us about the fireball.
Oh my gosh. So fireball happens after it gets dark. So as soon as the sun starts to go down, there's a lot of, you know, anticipation in the crowd. We're all kind of waiting. We know it's coming. And then they shut off all of the lights. And as the goalposts are placed at either end of the playing field, the tops of those posts, they're long, almost like tree height sort of sticks. And the top of the goalposts are also lit aflame. So that's kind of how you get your light. And there were a lot of men on the field. They're divided into two groups. And there had to have been well over 30, maybe up to 50 on the field. And a lot of them were playing, you know, shirtless, maybe like shoeless. And I think that makes sense because the fireball is exactly what it sounds like. You know, this flaming ball of cloth. It's been soaked in, I believe, kerosene or one of the other flammable liquids. And they light this ball on fire and they essentially play a game of sort of keep away kind of soccer handball combination. And I call it a game, but what it really is it's a healing ceremony. It's very sacred. There are no photos or videos permitted. And for good reason, I think seeing it happen before me, I was like, I'm glad that I'm not tasked with taking photos for the newspaper.
You can't do it justice, right?
It can't. It can't. I mean, seeing that ball of fire against the pitch black sky, just soaring through the air with all the embers trailing behind it. I mean, and then seeing someone catch that.
Wow.
It's unlike anything I've ever
imagined. Was it well attended? They usually are, right? Yeah.
It was packed. Yeah. They had tribal police officers kind of coming around and being like, you guys really got to back up, yeah. you know, because if this ball comes your way, it's on fire.
You're not going to catch it, right?
Yeah, no, definitely not going to catch it. I did see the ball, the fireball at one point did go over the barrier, and David Whedon stepped right up to throw it back in. And I was like, oh my gosh, he's so brave. I couldn't do that.
Another story in the Enterprise papers is Black Widow spiders on Cape Cod?
Yes.
Who knew?
Well, and I hate to add to the stress of anyone who's already skittish over the great white sharks and the ticks, but I do have one more critter to tell you about. So, so an East Falmouth resident, Lacey Blumel, she spotted a Black Widow spider October 2023. And she was like, well, that's concerning, you know?
But it's only one.
Only one.
Then
and then this summer she has seen more than six on her property. It started when she went out and she was watering, you know, some of her plants, and she spotted a female, and she has a young child and also a dog. So that was really concerning for her. So she said she got some bug spray, sprayed it, and you know, was keeping an eye on it. And then she started seeing more and more. So that first one she saw had those, you know, kind of iconic red markings of the Black Widow. The females have those. The males do not.
And it's the females that bite, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
Yes. So the females are the ones that bite. The males are typically a little bit smaller, too. So that's how we've been told by the experts. You can tell that they're a little bit different. But contrary to what you might think about a venomous spider, these guys are actually kind of shy. They tend to be not super aggressive.
That's
the great news. One of our own copy editors, actually, after we found out about this story, she lives in Hatchville, and she came into the newsroom and told us that she was watering her garden, and she must have hit, you know, with the water one of these spiders, and she saw him kind of skitter away. And then she flips it over, and actually, I guess it was a girl, because she flipped over whatever it ran under, and it was there with what seemed to be an egg sac.
Uh-oh.
I know. So that's very concerning.
Thank you, climate change, right?
Right, exactly, because that's actually exactly what experts are saying. You know, we haven't gotten the snow and that deep freeze that, you know, we need to kind of kill these off. So with climate warming, the experts are kind of thinking these guys might be here to stay.
Yeah. So you keep your eye out, right?
Keep your eye out. I said, those the females are the ones with that distinctive red hourglass marking, and those are the ones who have a venomous bite.
And so hopefully if you leave them alone, they'll leave you alone.
I hope so. I do hope so. But we've got some experts looking into it. After we did our story, someone actually reached out to us. His name is Eric Edwards, and he lives in Quissett. And he was telling us that he and his father, who has since passed on, they actually at one point did an 8-year study during the late 1980s and early 90s looking at spiders that they found in mailbox. I believe that at the time, Eric Edwards was a mail carrier. Mm-hmm. So, you know, going into people's mailbox, he's probably seeing tons of these. His father, who was a biologist, they started, you know, collecting information and kind of logging all of these. So when he saw our story, he emailed us and was like, I would love to connect with the homeowner, maybe go out there, get some specimens and photos and stuff. So we were able to connect him with Lacey, which was really cool. And he said that, you know, in their 25 years of collecting, they've never found widows on the Cape. Never before. And kind of a bummer, when he did go to Lacey's property, she had already had a Terminator come out. So they the spiders were gone. But she did have really good photo evidence, which is, if you're brave enough, available on our website, capenews.net. But she shared that photo with Eric, and, you know, a couple more photographs that she and her husband had taken. And he did confirm they are definitely northern black widows.
All right. Callie Remillard from the Enterprise Newspapers. Thanks, Callie.
Thanks so much.
Despite some rain, our region's still facing drought conditions, and despite water restrictions on Nantucket, water usage remains high. Josh Balling from the Enquirer and Mirror joins us. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
So tell us what's going on.
Well, there's a lot of water being used. On Sunday night, the water level in the Wanacomet Water Company's tank on Washington Pond stood at 90 feet. By Monday morning, it had dropped to 67 feet, which is a decline of about 400,000 gallons overnight, even as the water company was pumping 3,000 gallons a minute back into the tank. So these island-wide drought restrictions, which are in place regarding watering and irrigation, they've been in effect since June 20th, don't appear to be slowing down water usage all that much. And it certainly didn't help that there hasn't been really much rain at all until last night, any time over the last week or so either. This dramatic use came as the island pumped more than 4.2 million gallons of water last Sunday, nearly the all-time high of 4.6 million gallons in a day. Wanakamet Water Company Director Mark Willett said that this kind of demand is more typical of late August, and it's happening despite these mandatory irrigation restrictions due to Nantucket being classified as in a level one drought by the state. The concern is, too, not just about having adequate reserve of water, but tank volume dictates water pressure, which is critical for firefighting. And thankfully, Willett said that the water pressure held steady last Thursday when firefighters were battling a fire at a home on Pinecrest Drive, so they weren't really affected. But the concern is that if the water levels in the tanks get too low, it really lowers the water pressure, and that can seriously affect the fire department's ability to fight fires.
Yeah, so obviously not really paying a lot of attention to the water restrictions. Does that mean they're going to get a little bit tougher on enforcing them, increase the fines? What's the thought there?
It absolutely does. As a matter of fact, that the Water Commission approved the issuance of penalties. Violators will first receive a phone call and a warning, and if that excessive use continues, they're going to face escalating fines of $250 for the next offense, $500 for the offense after that, and if anybody actually violates the restrictions for a fourth time, they're going to have the water to their property shut off, not
wow.
just to their irrigation systems, but to their properties. It's that the state does allow that. It seems rather draconian, and the water company says they don't really want to do that, but they have to send a message somehow, so they're hoping not to, but they will do it if you violate the restrictions for a fourth time.
Yeah. And what about folks on private wells?
Private wells are not impacted by these restrictions. They're responsible for their own wells. If their wells go dry, that's on them. And a lot of a lot of the lawns you see being irrigated on the island, Mark Willett was quick to point out, they're not necessarily violating. They probably have their own private well. But at the same time, obviously, a lot of water is being used because the water in the water tanks are going down, and those are all on municipal water. So there is some violations out there. Apparently, they have pretty sophisticated monitoring systems at the water company, and they can tell minute by minute, hour by hour, and when a ton of water is being used in the overnight hours, people probably aren't taking showers or washing dishes. They're probably irrigating their lawns.
Right. So what's the criteria for lifting restrictions?
We have to get out of the drought condition. We're only at level one, and we're not going to go to level two, apparently, when the next time the state issues their drought levels, which is coming up very soon. But once we're out of the drought qualification or characterization, then the water restrictions will be lifted.
All right, moving to another story we've got this week. We've got some PFAS levels higher than previously thought.
Right. Talking about wells again. A private well on Oak Hollow Lane in the middle of the island close to the South Shore tested at more than eight times the state's safe limit for PFAS, and another nearby on Hummock Pond Road came in just shy of what the state calls imminent hazard threshold, the latest sign that contamination from PFAS on the island is more extensive than previously thought. This latest round of residential testing by MassDEP, the home on Oak Hollow Lane tested at 171 parts per trillion, which is nearly double the level required to be classified as an imminent hazard. The home on Hummock Pond Road tested at 87 parts per trillion, just below the 90 PPT threshold, but that's still more than four times higher than the state's safe drinking water limit of 20 parts per trillion.
Wow. And this doesn't affect the public water is not testing as high?
Public water, for the most part, is not testing, I shouldn't say not testing at all, is being tested, but it is not showing any levels of PFAS for the most part. A couple of the wells have, on occasion, shown very low levels of PFAS, so the municipal water supply so far has been basically PFAS-free. Mark Willett, again, from the water company, says that's likely because the wells the town uses is drawing from an aquifer that's much deeper than the private wells draw from, and that so far has not been subject, that aquifer has not been subject to PFAS contamination.
So what are they giving for advice for folks who want to decrease those levels in those private wells? Is there anything they can do?
Unfortunately, there's really not much they can do. They're attempting to determine where the PFAS is coming from, but in addition to calling them forever chemicals, they're everywhere chemicals. Mm-hmm. PFAS is in it's in cookware, it's in the fire retardant, it's in foul weather gear. It's in everything, and it breaks down. It doesn't break down, but it does leach into groundwater, into the ground from the landfill, from the airport. Have been two spots that have tested particularly high. But you can eliminate those immediate sources. The airport's no longer using the firefighting foam that was mandated by the FAA for decades that had high levels of PFAS in it. But it's still there. We have a landfill. There's lots of PFAS in a lot of the stuff that goes into the landfill. So basically, homes that test that high, they're being provided with bottled water. And also, there are filtration systems that can be installed onto pumps and onto sinks and showers that will largely take care of the PFAS. So it is a treatable problem, but it's not necessarily a solvable problem, at least at this point.
All right, Josh Bolling from the Inquirer Mirror. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Coming up, New Bedford City Councilors flip their vote and defund the Zeiterion, and an interesting approach to affordable housing. Stay with us. You are listening to the News Roundup on The Point. Police in Provincetown investigating two anti-gay bias crimes. And joining us with the details is Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Mindy.
This is pretty distressing news.
Yes, and, you know, it's the first such episode since about 2017, which is even farther in the past than I expected. So it is unusual here.
And so tell us what happened. One was a physical assault and the other was verbal?
Right. One of these is still under active investigation. That is a situation that happened late in the night, well, early in the morning of June 30th, in which the man says he was pushed down from behind and then really repeatedly kicked while being called anti-gay slurs. The three suspects then drove off in a black Lexus. The police have been looking for video footage from that neighborhood. This was in the early morning hours around Howland Street, so they're gathering material. They didn't get the report until relatively later in the day on that Monday, so that investigation is going on. Mm-hmm. The other, the very next day in the evening on July 1st, a different car with three people drove down Bradford Street hurling anti-gay and actually anti-black slurs at passersby, one of whom was on a bicycle, turned around, tried to follow the car, eventually got their license plate. And so those people were apprehended by the police, you know, before they were able to leave town, and they were charged with disorderly conduct, all three of them.
Yeah. And the town held a public forum just to talk to people who might be a little bit worried about their safety. What did they say?
They talked about making sure your phone is charged before you go out, being with your friends as much as you can, being really conscious when you are walking alone, having, if you can take photos and videos safely and it's not putting yourself in danger to do so, then those can be really helpful, and making a report immediately so the police can investigate, so they can do what they can, and so that there's a record of these things happening.
Right. And then over New Offleet, an interesting approach to create some affordable housing. This is a community land trust. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. In a land trust, this idea has been used in Vermont and in Martha's Vineyard. A nonprofit holds the land itself and sells only the house. So the structure, you know, a lot of the value of property out here in the Cape and Islands is baked into the land. So if you sell just the structure, a lot of times you're looking at 60% of the sticker price that you would have otherwise had, and you take something that would have been $1.5 million and you can drop it back down into the $800,000 range, and all of a sudden it becomes something that a local person or a local family with two local incomes can actually get a mortgage for.
And so where are we in the process with it? We have somebody who has the land and is going to sell the house just for what it costs?
Yes. So in this case, we don't have a land trust on Cape Cod yet. The Cape Cod Commission is working on, you know, organizing some volunteers to get one started. In the meantime, this person didn't really want to wait, so he bought a piece of land and is having the house built with some modular construction. It's actually a house and an ADU. And is going to sell that more or less at building cost to a family who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford, you know, a single family home in Wellfleet is north of $1 million.
Right.
So by getting the number back down into the 700s, you get a house that people can actually get a loan for, and you make home ownership possible. Of course, when they go to resell it, they're selling only the structure. The land is still part of that nonprofit, so it doesn't appreciate at quite the same rate, but that's, you know, that's okay. It means you get to have a home.
Yeah. This will be interesting to follow and see how this could, you know, be setting a model for other affordable housing projects. Great idea.
Yeah, it's very clear that other towns, you know, Truro has the Walsh property. People who have been involved in that committee are interested in what it would be like to, you know, let the town hold some of the land and just let people buy structures. You know, you can get into much more deeply achievable prices when the land comes out of the equation.
Right. All right. Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Mindy.
New Bedford's Zeiterion Theater has been thrown into a bit of chaos after city councilors changed their minds on funding. Colin Hogan from the New Bedford Light has more on that story. Hi, Colin.
Hi, Mindy.
Tell us a little bit what's going on here.
So this year, the New Bedford City Council decided at its budget cut night that among the many cuts it was going to make, it was going to cut some funding from the Zyterian Theater, which is a city-owned theater building that is operated by a nonprofit. The problem was that earlier, last year in September, the council had agreed to a contract for the funding amount, and the budget night was just when that amount was being passed through. So when the council cut these funds away, it opened a little bit of chaos for the theater, both in taking some of the money away, but also because a new 99-year lease for the theater rested upon that agreement, which included the funding, and some of their other funding for a current renovation, including some bank loans, they told me, could be jeopardized by the city funding going away. So city councilors may have the chance to vote on this again if the mayor brings it back as a supplemental budget. But right now, the theater is sort of sounding the alarm, its president, Rosemary Gill, told me, that things are going chaotically and they need a solution.
Yeah. And currently, a big renovation's been happening.
Yeah, that's right. The Zyterian Theater has been closed now for about a year and a half. The 100-year-old theater was closed during the pandemic, and they decided that some of its old features, which were crumbling paint and cracks in the walls, needed to be fixed. And upon doing an assessment, decided that actually there is much more they could do to update the theater. So with a combination of ARPA funding, some grants from the state, and a big push by their donors, they decided to actually redo the entire theater. And starting in 2024, and with an end date of the end of this year, there's a $37 million project that's doing everything from, you know, adding new bathrooms, redoing the layout of the entrance and the lobby, adding a speakeasy bar to the basement. So it's a really big renovation project. And when one of the counselors who changed their mind about this vote told me about her thought process, she said, well, you know, they've been closed and I wasn't sure they needed the money. So the city counselors are sort of, I think, don't have this theater at the top of their mind, perhaps.
Yeah.
And that could explain their vote, maybe.
And the theater brings in, what, $11 million in economic impact to the region?
Yes, that's the argument that they make for why this public-private partnership is worth it. So the annual agreement for the city of New Bedford was they agreed to fund it at about $500,000 a year. And that's an amount that sort of rattled some city counselors. But the argument the theater makes is they bring in, you're correct, $11 million of economic impact. They provide programming to every child in New Bedford public schools. And a lot of businesses in the area, restaurants, you know, depend on some of the traffic that they bring to the area.
Right.
So there's a big, you know, cultural scene that revolves around the Zyterian, as well as economic and other impacts that it brings.
Yeah, well, more to come on this. Thank you, Colin. Colin Hogan from the New Bedford Light. Thanks for bringing us up to date on that story. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Out on New Hampshire's seacoast, University of New Hampshire researchers are placing solar-powered tags on salt marsh sparrows to better understand how restoration projects across New England are unfolding. NHPR's Julia Vaz met with the research team in Newmarket as they placed these backpack-like trackers on tiny birds.
We start walking to the marsh field at Lumberland Creek Preserve only a few minutes after sunrise.
Everyone have our snacks, our water, our... park, whatever we need.
The way down from the parking lot is not really a trail, more like a secret path.
This is the stump that is the ankle breaker right here.
Oh, wow, yeah.
When we finally reach the marsh, the expanse of green, bounded only by the sea in the distance, is almost overwhelming. Across the country, century-old salt marshes have been lost to development. Even healthy marshes, like this one in Newmarket, are at risk of disappearing because of sea level rise. I tread wobbly through the mud, feeling like a species outside my natural habitat. But not research Italia Kouros.
How are we looking over there, guys?
Like the birds she studies, she seems to fly above the marsh.
We are out at Lumberland Creek Preserve today, banding and tagging salt marsh sparrows with radio tags so that we can track and understand how they use the marsh.
Salt marsh sparrows are an indicator species, meaning the health of the bird's population is directly related to the health of the entire ecosystem. The data Talia and her team are gathering from the birds at this marsh site will help inform restoration and preservation efforts across other New England salt marshes, especially important as climate change reshapes the region's coastline.
As we see things like sea level change and increased severity of coastal storms, we're seeing more flooding in these nests, and flooding is the biggest cause of failure of these nests. So as they flood more, we have fewer salt marsh sparrows out here.
One way to get the data needed to understand these tiny birds and how they behave is giving the birds a solar-powered tagged backpack.
It's like a backpack for your legs.
Yeah, leg backpack. Yes. A fanny pack almost. Thank you.
It's not on their wings like we would wear a backpack, but it does sit over their back.
Exactly. Each tag has a specific radio ID.
So that when it's picked up on our radio receiver grid, we can know exactly who that bird is and which tag signal is being received.
By tagging the birds and setting up sensors on the marsh, the team can then see how the birds are moving and draw conclusions about their behavior. Did their breeding change after restoration? Where do they typically nest or mate? The whole operation is a three-step process. First, Tali and her team set up these vertical, portable nets at the edge of the marsh to safely catch flying sparrows. But after waiting a few minutes, the nets remain empty. So it's time for the team to make some noise and get the sparrows to come out of their hiding spots on the tall grasses.
Are you good?
If you are.
The researchers repeat this process a few times, hoping to catch a bird still untagged, until seasonal field technician Denny Tipton comes back with a bird secured inside a small cloth bag.
Does he have a backpack already?
No. So, if he's of tagging weight, we will do that.
Oh, I hope.
It's a male bird, brown with a sprinkle of white and orange feathers, and strong enough for a backpack. Now begins the second part of the process. Danny delicately holds the bird's legs between his fingers and prepares to place a tag.
First, we're going to put one of these little leg loops that extends beyond the tag on the bottom of it onto one of its legs. Then we're going to move that loop all the way up over this hip joint that we have up here under the wing. And then a tag is going to sit right on top of the back there.
It's difficult to loop the small straps through the bird's legs, and crochet skills come in handy.
So we'll use a crochet hook to find this other leg loop, and now that's going to get stretched up over its other leg.
Now that the tag has been placed, a small wide tail sticking out from between the bird's wings, Denny can make sure that the bird feels no discomfort.
And that's feeling pretty perfect.
And then we reach the third and final step. We let him fly away.
Very nice.
Off to collect this data.
As I prepare to leave Bird City, as the team calls the marsh, undergraduate student Kara Hatowski brings out one more surprise.
We got babies!
Yay.
Kara walks over with four baby birds inside a baseball cap.
They're so talkative.
They are still too small to tag, but Talia and the others take some measurements and prepare to go catch some more birds.
Danny and Cara, you guys want to keep nest searching and poking around and stuff?
Happily.
But I keep walking ahead, a little more used to walking around the mud until I can't hear the sparrows anymore, and the marsh is once again a secret. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Julia Vaz.
And the story came to us from the New England News Collaborative. Thanks to all the journalists who joined us for the News Roundup today. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.